From GPP News, this is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. Today we travel the length of Georgia, bringing stories from the north, the middle, and the southeast. We'll search for the lost towns of North Georgia first, then look at how two churches in Macon hope to heal the wounds of the Civil War and segregation. Finally, we'll hear from a poet in Savannah. And you know your voice is an important part of the show. What is interesting about the place where you live? What makes your city or town unique? Call us at 404-500-9457, post on Facebook or tweet us at OST Talk, and we might feature your comments on the show. We think of ghosts as the spiritual remains of people who've died, but towns can produce ghosts as well. In Georgia, there were thriving communities that now exist only in historical documents, ruins, or old photos. Lisa Russell teaches at Georgia Northwestern Technical College. She studied some of these communities for her book, Lost Towns of North Georgia. She joined us last year by Skype from her home in Bartow County.
Well, when I moved to Bartow County, I started going to church there, First Cassville Baptist Church, and I noticed the church was very, very old. It was built in 1914, I believe. But I started hearing the stories about the church and how it survived. The original building survived the burning up from Sherman, the Civil War, and how the soldiers used to turn the pews upside down and use them for horse troughs. So I hear these stories, and I just was so interested for years and years. I've thought about it and rattled it around in my head until I just thought, I'm going to write this. So I wrote to History Press and I said, I've got this idea. And they loved it, but they loved even more that if I covered a lot more of the North Georgia area, which, by the way, I did as much as I could in the time frame and the research time I had. I'm after writing it, there's so many more that I didn't write about that I look forward to writing about in the future.
We spoke with also paranormal genealogist Shannon Byers, yeah, who's in Gwinnett County. Yeah, and she says she accepts the term ghost town. Here's her reasoning.
It's not just ghosts of, you know, the people that may have lived there. It's ghosts of the buildings. You know, ghost doesn't always mean dead person. You know, it's something left from the past that's still haunting other people. Now, whether that be a building, whether that be a spirit, it doesn't matter. Ghost towns is a perfect term.
And I wonder how you feel, and if you feel the same, because you ended up visiting a lot of different places. Do you think ghost town is the right word or phrase to use?
That was the original title of the book, but the publisher decided to use lost towns. I feel like they're ghost towns. I feel like she was saying, that there's like a presence, and that's what drew me, especially like to Cassville. When you drive through Cassville now, it's like a three-way stop to nowhere. You know, there's a three-way stop, and there's really nothing left of what it used to be. It used to be one of the biggest towns between Chattanooga and Atlanta in the 1840s, but now it's nothing. I mean, there's nothing there, and it's just fascinating to me. When I go by places that are like that, and we all see them everywhere, where you drive through a town, it's like something draws you. If you're like me, it draws you in the older places. You want to know what happened there. Why is it not there anymore? What was inside? And that was my quest, is to find out why. And that little town made a big difference in the end. Like the town of Lindale, if it wasn't for the pictures that were taken by a photographer in the 1900s, we might not have had children labor laws because of the pictures that were taken at the mill at Lindale in 1914. So what little things that we think are insignificant, even these ghost towns, had a purpose and a time.
And Lindale was a pretty sizable community at the time. How did it disappear?
Because of the industry.
When child labor laws came in, then...
No, it was later than that. They actually saved it to the... I forgot the year. Wasn't too long ago.
Yeah, just like about a decade ago, maybe?
Yeah, yeah. And they kept... they got rid of the mill town aspect. So people said, well, there's still Lindale. Yes, there is still a place called Lindale. But it's not the mill town that it was in the 30s and the, you know, but the child labor laws were really changed things, but it was really during the Depression era that the child labor laws became really stuck. They started in the 20s, and then you know how Congress is, they changed it and everything, but it really stuck during the New Deal, and then children came out of the plants and were going to school and things like that. But there was a photographer named William Lewis Hine. He's in the National Archives. He went around the country taking pictures of children. And many of the pictures in my book are pictures from Lindale. There's actually a guy named, his name was Norman Hall.
The 10-year-old?
Yes.
Yeah, who was working at the
mill. Yeah, he said he was 12.
He lied so he could work
Yeah, they
there.
Lied. Yes. So it's really interesting. And my son looked it up for me and found out he was actually lived a pretty good life till, I guess, to the 1960s. And we found his grave in Woodstock, Georgia. So it was interesting to follow his, you know, him as a child laborer to 1962.
My guest is Lisa Russell, author of the book Lost Towns of North Georgia. I wonder if there's a special poignancy to communities that disappeared because of violence. Let me go back to Shannon Byers, because we're going to talk about Skull Shoals. She, again, is a paranormal genealogist out of Gwinnett County. And she has descendants that lived in Skull Shoals, and they died there in 1793.
They were having a lot of problem with the Creek Indians, who would come across the river and raid their cattle and try to do harm to people. And my great aunt and uncle, Richard and Mary Thrasher, along with two of their children and a servant, were actually scalped and massacred by the Creek.
Now, she describes the Indians coming across and doing harm to people, but that was Indian land that they were on at that time. What did you find out about Skull Shoals?
Skull Shoals was really the most haunting place that I went to.
Literally?
This is the whole story of it. The mill towns that were there, the paper mill and then the cotton mill. And I went with, it's funny. Shannon's amazing. She does her homework, and I got a lot of the research from her, and she actually showed me original documents and things that she had done a research about her relatives. And there's an organization called Friends of Skull Shoals, and they do a wonderful job keeping the history alive. But Shannon has a different dimension to her story. And I ended my book with her telling me that there was finally peace she calls it the Shoals. The name sounds gross. Creepy too, but really a skull was it's not like the skull on Halloween. It's the skull of a paddle, an oar.
Yeah. Rafting down or canoeing
right.
down the river.
But it was the buildings are, if you go in there, and it's really hard to find. In fact, I was joking. Here I am with a person with gifts, psychic gifts, and we got lost with two GPS. We couldn't find our way. So we finally found it again. She had been there, but forgot where it was. And I just thought that was funny that, you know, she couldn't find it. So we went in there and we walked around. And it was a creepy cold day, really, and raining. And we walked around and just the ghosts of the buildings, like she was talking about, if you look at the pictures in the book or online. It's just the, you know, remnants of an old manufacturing building, you know, and those of us who live in North Georgia know there's a lot of those around, a lot of old cotton mills and things like that. And to see it in that disrepair and a fireplace, like someone had just left, you know, it's just it's creepy. Even the water, right, the Oconee River is right there. And basically what killed the manufacturing, was the water. They had farmed the land so much that the water, the dirt had got into the water and it ruined. They either flooded or they had drought, and either way, it messed up the manufacturing.
I'm wondering what you came away with after visiting all these towns that were once, many of them, thriving and quite large and have disappeared.
Right.
What do you take away? What is left behind in a place when a community leaves?
Well, starting back at Cassville, when I realized that there were two colleges there, I mean, in 1840, there were two full colleges there, and it was a very cultural place. That just blows me away, you know, because there's nothing there. And I wondered about that through the whole book and everyone while I was writing it. And what I came down was that there's time that they were there for the people that were there, and their purpose was done, and the town disintegrated for one reason or the other. Some are being repurposed, you know, but for the most part, they're gone. And we need to remember them, especially places like Skull Shoals that are just really hard to find.
Why do we need to remember them?
There's something about the story of old towns that it gives us a foundation for the future if we want to listen. But we always learn from the past. That's just what I get out of it, and that everything has a purpose and every person has a purpose, and figure that out, you know, to fulfill that purpose.
That is Lisa Russell. She is author of the book Lost Towns of North Georgia. Lisa, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
When a person dies, a part of them can remain with the living. That's the case for one spirit in Savannah at the Sorrel Weed House Museum.
Well, my name is Nicholas Wood. I'm the operations manager at the Sorrel Weed House Museum in Savannah, Georgia. One of the interesting things about the house is the fact that you can't go a day or a night without something unexplainable happening. Lately, since we've been acquiring a lot of artifacts and bringing them into the museum, we've noticed that it seems we might have a new apparition on the property. And it's got people concerned because one of the things that is commonly happening that we've never experienced before is things are starting to get thrown at us. You know, we've had a candle that was in the dining room that just sheared completely off, went flying off the sideboard table and across the room in front of guests during a tour. One of the very first experiences in the house for me, I had gotten comfortable with my routine. I operate on a routine, so I'm going through the house. I'm presenting their historical tales to guests, and all of a sudden, a big old chunk of metal comes flying through the air from behind the tour guide and narrowly misses her head. And six guests are watching this with their jaws on the floor. All of a sudden, some of us are getting pushed or tripped or just something seems to be trying to make itself known to us. And it's been getting kind of scary lately. I mean, we're quite used to paranormal activity, but lately there's something definitely going on in the house that is new even to us. And this particular evening, I broke my routine. I started opening up the house sort of in a backwards order. And I was very casual about it. Normally, I would be on my toes. You know, in the beginning, I was really scared, really freaked out by the house. And so I'd get through the house by myself as quickly as possible to get it set up. But this day, I was real comfortable, real casual. I was eating a Rice Krispie treat. I'm just going through the house easy-like, and I open up the library door, and right across the foyer is the entrance to the gentleman's parlor. Typically, most days, that door would be completely closed, but this day, I open up the library door, I look across the hall, and standing right in the doorway is an apparition, is a ghost, I guess the best way to describe it. I'm seeing a lady's dress. It's all belled out, very antebellum style, frilly, poofy shoulders with lots of lace. The dress, I could see it just as real as I could see anything else with my eyes. It had a small flower print on it, in fact. And I'm staring at this, and I'm blinking rapidly, and what I'm seeing wearing the dress is really just a shadow, but not like a dark shadow like you see cast against light. It was almost like a shadow, but white, or just sort of opaque, the outline of a woman wearing this dress. And I was floored. I was absolutely so stunned. It happened so quickly, you don't have time to really be terrified or scared of what you're seeing. You just are trying to comprehend it. Blink 8 or 9 times and it just turns to mist and just disappears. At that point, I didn't know if I wanted to walk forward and continue opening up the house or if I wanted to turn around and get the heck out. Definitely one I'll never forget, my very first experience inside the Sorrel Weed Mansion.
Nicholas Wood is the operations manager at the Sorrel Weed House Museum in Savannah. Coming up, a poet creates beauty from his troubled family past. But first, two churches in Macon, one black, one white, now share a common mission. This is On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headley. This is On Second Thought. If you walk out the front door of the First Baptist Church in Macon, turn the corner of the building and look through the trees, you'll see the First Baptist Church of Christ. 170 years ago, they were one congregation. Now there's a black Baptist church and a white one. But the pastors want to mend that rift. We spoke last year with the pastors from both churches, Reverend James Goolsby of First Baptist Church and Reverend Scott Dickison of First Baptist Church of Christ. James, tell me about the initial rift back in just after the Civil War, I guess, 170 years ago. Why did the churches split apart?
There's, I guess, a general belief that with the culture of the country at the time, with the fact that a majority of the membership of the combined church was African-American, but not in any leadership capacity, and then the majority of that number were slaves, that just the thought of whether direction the country was going, that it was better for the churches to worship separately. And that's kind of the gist of it. And separate church was built on property for the African Americans and grew separately from that. So it's something that happened with the way the culture was, with the way the sign of the times, with, again, with slavery and just the being in the South, it led to that separation.
Scott, what do you think of the history? I mean, we can imagine, but I wonder what kind of real evidence we have about what James is describing. Before the Civil War, this was a church where slave owners would come and they'd bring their slaves. So to a certain extent, it wasn't entirely unified.
No. And, I think one thing that's important to point out is that our church is really more representative of the church in America in that time. And really, the more we've looked into it, I think representative of the Church of America throughout our history, we've kind of followed the ebbs and flows, at least as far as race relations and divisions within the church. But the church was formed in 1826, and for the first 20 years was worshiped together whites and blacks, which was what was done back then. Of course, after a number of slave rebellions. African Americans were not allowed to congregate without white supervision. And so we see that in our church's history. After the initial split in 1845 for the next 20 years until the end of the Civil War, when the black members met, they would do so under the supervision of the white pastor, who was the kind of overseer of that congregation as well. So, very complicated, but also, again, I think what we found to be so special about our history is that it's not so special, that it really is representative of the church in that time.
So, James, for 170 years, these churches have been, they're within spitting distance also, I guess, if you're a really good spitter. Why is this the first time there's really been serious talk of I guess, not merging the churches, but mending fences?
This is actually not the first time. There have been pulpit swaps in the 70s, attempts made to have certain relationships between the church, but I don't think there's been a concerted effort like it has been during this time. A lot of it has to do with Scott and I's participation in the New Baptist Covenant, mm-hmm. Which gave us a framework to work to try and develop relationships between the churches.
So, James, you're not talking about merging the congregations in terms of merging all into one under one roof, right?
That's correct.
So what does this effort mean, this concerted effort?
As we all know, it's been often said that the most segregated time of in the U.S. is on Sunday mornings. But what that does also is it prevents people from especially Christians, to getting to know one another beyond the racial divide. We've experienced so much in terms of just getting to know our neighbors, getting to know our coworkers that we would work with on everyday basis, but not really understand them in terms of their faith. And as a result of just the interaction, the things that we've done together, the conversation that we're getting ready to have has already proven to be tremendously effective in just getting to know our brothers and sisters in Christ. And so that has been amazing, and we're excited about where we feel that's going.
Scott, what have been the obstacles? I mean, obviously, it's been 170 years. This is the first, I think you described it as a concerted effort. Why has it been difficult before?
Well, probably for a lot of the same reasons that it's been difficult for our country. I'd like to say as a pastor that the church has been a leader in racial reconciliation in our country's history, but unfortunately, that's not really been the case. I think you've seen churches line up on both sides throughout the last certainly 150 years since end of the Civil War, and I think our church has just been again representative of that whole trend of just following the dominant culture's lead in terms of how we view our neighbors, how we separate ourselves and live kind of parallel lives in a lot of ways. And that's really what our churches have done. You know, there hasn't been, you know, animosity or, ill feelings. There just hasn't really been much relationship at all. That's really where we focused our energies is let's build a relationship. And from that relationship, hopefully build the trust that's necessary to really dig deeper into our histories and how we might use our church's history, our shared history, as a lens through which to view the racial history of the church and the country.
That is Scott Dickison of the First Baptist Church of Christ. We also spoke with Reverend James Goolsbee of the First Baptist Church. Scott and James, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Roughly 30% of Americans say they seldom or never attend religious services. That's up from the last decade, according to the Pew Research Center. Staying excited and alert during church can be a challenge for some, like Homer Simpson.
Which brings us back to our starting point, the 9 tenets of constancy.
Damn it!
Well, I seem to have lost my place. So I'll start over.
Aw, for the love of crumb cake.
But one church on Tybee Island is reaching out to the Homer Simpsons of the world, those who don't feel a connection to a traditional church.
Dancing with you as you sing over me. There's nothing else that I'd rather do. Oh, Lord, than to worship you.
It's not unusual to hear rock music inside Benny's Bar on Tybee Island, but only on Sunday is that music about God. I wanted to learn more about this special service, so in 2015 I talked with the church's pastor, Michael Elliott, and worshiper David Cahill. I started off asking Michael if having church in a bar is disrespectful.
Well, Jesus didn't start in a church. I mean, he started in people's homes and in public places and worship, and I'm sure he went to at least one bar. At least he turned water into wine at a wedding. And so, way before stained glass, there was good worship. And so we have gone back to reclaiming church without stained glass.
And do you allow drinking in the church, other than communion wine, I guess?
We have very good communion wine. Let me start with that. When we do, it's very good. But, in the state of Georgia, we have church at 10 o'clock on Sunday mornings. State of Georgia, you can't serve alcohol until after 12:30. Although I'm sure if those laws changed, people might try to have more communion.
David, what's the thought? Why was this church needed?
It was needed because a lot of people, they felt really uncomfortable being in a traditional church and hearing somebody's interpretation of the Bible as to how they need to live their life. And then when Sam presented this idea to me, at first I was a little skeptic because I'm thinking to myself, you're wanting to do what and do it where? And he was one of my really good friends, and I jumped in with both feet, and I haven't looked back. I enjoy every bit of it.
I wanted to play you a clip from this actually went on YouTube. This is a spoken word poem from a man named Jefferson Bethke. It's called Why I Hate Religion But Love Jesus, and it's gotten more than 30 million views on YouTube. Take a listen.
See, the problem with religion is it never gets to the core. It's just behavior modification like a long list of chores. Like, let's dress up the outside, make it look nice and neat. But it's funny, that's what they used to do to mummies while the corpse rots underneath. Now I ain't judging, I'm just saying, quit putting on a fake look. Because there's a problem if people only know that you're a Christian by your Facebook. I mean, in every other aspect of life, you know that logic's unworthy. It's like saying you play for the Lakers just because you bought a jersey.
So Michael, I wanted to put this to you. It's gotten so many views, I think, because it's resonated especially with younger people. But if you just move the church service inside a bar, how does that address what he's really talking about there?
Well, I think it's two things. I think he's acknowledging the fact that organized and institutionalized religion, as exists especially in the United States over the past couple of centuries, has become a place of dogma and not acceptance. A place of rules and not relationship. a place where you go to celebrate your guilt rather than a place where you go to feel guilt-free. And at Bar Church, I can tell you, when we gather together, I mean, it's a crazy little unplanned, non-institutional, wickedly wild worship experience. I mean, people show up, they bring food, we convert pool tables into potluck banquet tables. People show up to eat. A bar band turns into playing a plethora of music that ranges from hymns to contemporary songs that have spiritual meanings. And then there's a lot of sharing, a lot of acceptance, a lot of all the things that you don't find behind those buildings with stained glasses and steeples. And so, you know, I think we embody, you capture what he is saying very well in this non-scripted experience.
Well, let me actually, let's take a listen to that church band. Here they are performing at the Oceanside Nursing Home. David, were you going to church regularly before you started attending the church in the, you call it Bar Church, is that correct?
Tybee Bar Church, that's exactly right. No, I was not attending a traditional church. When I was young, I was raised Catholic, and it was a force of habit for me to go to church. It was something that, I mean, I did out of habit. And I went there, you know, I'd balance my checkbook, I'd make out my grocery list, see what bills I had to pay, and never really gave the message much thought. And after, you know, my marriage here and I moved out to Tybee, church was the farthest thing from my mind. The only time I really went to church was on Christmas and on Easter. And when Sam and I, we got to be real close.
You mentioned Sam before. Sam Adams, you and he helped found the church.
Correct. And when he presented this idea to me, at first I was thinking it was going to be typical Tybee. Something's new. After 6 months, the news is going to wear off. People will quit. And it's done nothing but grow and grow and grow and grow. And I don't know how many followers we have on Facebook, but it's getting to be quite a few. And we're getting a lot of new faces in church that are from out of town that they're absolutely just loving this.
So do you go now every weekend?
Oh, yeah. I'm there every Sunday. I'm there.
Okay, so let me make sure. I'm going to fact check you here and make sure you are paying attention. What was the message this past Sunday?
You'd have to ask Michael on that one. I do go there. I've got a wife that you know, she's not doing too good, and I get a text during church. And she said, "Can you, if there's fruit, can you please bring me a plate of fruit right now?" So as Michael was speaking, I load her up for her plate of fruit, take it to her.
Well, there you go.
See how popular I am when it comes to the sermon stuff.
Michael, what was your message this past weekend?
It was on the parable of the talents, and it was about how Jesus left us with ideas because he didn't have any money and he didn't have any other things, but he left us ideas of love and acceptance. And, you know, we either take that message and we multiply it and we gain more love and acceptance, or we just sit on it and nothing happens, and that's where you find hell.
So is this, I understand this is a non-denominational church, but is it basically a Christian church?
Yes, although we are very open to multiple ways of expressing your love of God. Our orientation is predominantly Christian, yes, but we've had some great spiritual and, you know, even non-Christian expressions of their love for God. I mean, we're an accepting bunch, and, you know, you come as you are and you bring who you are, and whatever that is, you know, we'll figure out some way to work it in.
So what are you missing by preaching in this particular church? You don't have a daycare or Sunday school, right? You wouldn't want to, I mean, do people bring children into the bar?
Yeah, children do come. We don't have Sunday school. And, you know, we don't have evening services, although people gather in their own as kind of an outgrowth for Bible studies or for support groups or for those kinds of things. We also do the nursing home ministry. We also have special services for the holidays for people who have nowhere to go. And so, you know, Christmas and Thanksgiving and, you know, we open up and there's a big party, basically. And so we give a place, a home for people who don't have a home, regardless if they're living in a house.
That was a portion of my conversation with Michael Elliott. He's pastor of Bar Church on Tybee Island. I also spoke with David Cahill, who helped found that church. Sunday services start at 10 a.m. inside Benny's Bar on Tybee.
Felt like the weight of the world was on my shoulders. Pressure to break or retreat at every turn. Facing the fear that the truth had discovered. No telling how.
Coming up, his father was a soldier, his mother a Korean comfort woman. But this Georgia poet has turned heartbreak into beauty. This is On Second Thought.
Cost me everything I have.
It's On Second Thought. I'm Celeste Headlee. Decades ago, a Vietnam veteran stationed in South Korea met a Korean comfort woman. But their story did not end after one night. They married and had a child, and that child grew up to be a writer, Sojourner McCrae. His recent work is inspired by his parents' unconventional relationship. Sojourner took all his thoughts and feelings about his parents and poured them into his first book of poetry. It's called Rapture, and in 2015 it won the prestigious Walt Whitman Award from the Academy of American Poets. Sojourner McCrae joined us from our GPB studio in Savannah. Let's talk first about your parents, since that at least is not just the source for a lot of poetry, but I read an astounding essay that you'd written where you were comparing your mother to a superhero. So let me go back to when your father was stationed in Korea and he met your mother as a comfort woman, who's basically a prostitute, a call girl.
Right, right.
When did he fall in love with her? How long before he fell in love?
You know, I think that, you know, when you're writing this book, I have to sort of fill in the gaps. But I would imagine that he fell in love with her the second time he went back. He kept going back to the same person. And so I would assume that he fell in love with her the second time he went back. He also, I think he fell in love with her. He told me a story where he had proposed marriage and she said no. He proposed marriage again later on and she said no. And then the third time she found out she was pregnant and then she said yes. So
when did you, I can't imagine this was part of your, you know, annual family dinner talking about this. When did you find out?
My father, they had separated when I was in high school. They had separated when I was a child. And the types of women that he liked were prostitutes, which is difficult for me to say, but those were the women that he liked. And so, you know, in high school,
How did you know that? He was dating them?
Well, I mean, we had a very sort of very frank relationship, and I think that there was no cover up. These were the types of women that he liked. He wouldn't talk about it all the time, but I just knew. In high school, I just started to put pieces together. It was like a bad episode of CSI. I'm putting all the pieces together, and I just asked him one day, was my mother one of these types of women? And he said yes. I guess he figured, you're old enough to know.
And she had her own issues, which we can talk about in a moment, but I was hoping you would read first one of your poems, which was inspired by their relationship. Would you read the poem Yellow Apples?
Okay. Yellow Apples. She brings yellow apples and stands outside the motel in the same lime dress he's seen her in the last 6 times. Cinched at the waist and modestly cut. And if she stands perfectly still, maybe he'll overlook her cheap black flats where the outline of each toe makes her vulnerable, even done up with her hair curled. It's late evening. A mild breeze runs down the hill, and moonlight falls on her crumpled bag which sags a little from the apples. For a moment, she forgets why she's standing there, diaphragm and condoms in her purse.
I wonder, I mean, you write many kinds of things. You write prose as well. Why was poetry the right format for to describe your parents?
You know, I just think poetry is sort of like the purest form. I think it's a very complicated lyrical relationship. And so poetry is just the right format. Plus, I think, like, you know, I had set out to write a book about my father. And the more I started writing, the more I started writing poems from my mother's perspective. And I just, you know, I actually gained a lot of empathy and sympathy for my mother, which I didn't have before until I started writing the poems. The book sort of, you know, transformed from a book about my father into a book about their relationship. And the fallout from that relationship. You know, I wouldn't like to think of myself as fallout, but, you know, I mean, it's the fallout, you know, you learn from your parents. And, you know, the latter half of the book is about, you know, what you learn and the difficulties of trying to navigate your own life, you know, based on their relationship.
Well, I want to kind of explore more why you didn't have a lot of sympathy for her and make sure our listeners understand why that is. Your mother had schizophrenia.
Right.
And she became, it sounds like, more and more violent.
Right.
You, as I said, you wrote this astonishing essay called X Factor. And I want to quote you. You say, "Mom was a mutant. I don't mean the leather-clad, provocative, X-wearing kind with I-beams, telepathy, or blue skin. She wasn't a glamorous mutant. She wasn't swathed in green fur or diamond-hard skin or accessorized with decorative horns. She heard voices. The CGI effects were all in her head. Most days, she would stand behind the kitchen curtain, the embroidered poppies trailing her back like flames, and scream."
Right.
What was that like for you, especially because your parents split growing up? And you were quite young when all this was happening, and your mom was known as the crazy Asian lady.
Right. I mean, you know, when I was a kid, you know, because my mother was, you know, mentally ill, I just sort of lived in a constant state of fear and anxiety because you never knew when one of these, you know, sort of manic sessions would just erupt. You just held on. Like, when it came, you held on. And I would, you know, I started to read comic books, and I started to just, you know, learn how to tune certain things out. You know, my father would just say, "Oh, your mother's sick." And that was just the sort of blanket statement he would make. But, you know, it was actually very scary, you know, because your mother is at the kitchen window and she's screaming, and it's not just, I mean, it's like a wail, you know.
Loud enough for all the neighbors to hear down
right,
the street.
Right, exactly. And so, you know, she's breaking dishes, you know, she's stabbing things in the, you know, in the air with knives. And it was just sort of like, you know, I don't think she would harm me.
But harmed, you know, your father.
Right, she, correct.
Yeah.
They fought a lot. It was a very sort of difficult time, but, eventually they separated and she went back to Korea and, you know, so there was that. And he was devastated, you know, as terrible as that relationship was, he was devastated when she left. I remember going downstairs in my grandmother's house to the basement and he was sitting on the sofa. And he had like a bag of her hair, which he had kept from, I guess, when she had cut her hair once. And he was just sobbing over this hair. So he loved her.
Did you ever see her again after she left? Did he?
You know, she came back, which is interesting, which, you know, because she was a prostitute and the, you know, relationship started as a transaction, you know, they had years of marriage and she came back when I was in high school, and he thought that they could, you know, he wanted that dream of a marriage, of an, you know, the American dream where you have a marriage and a family and a life. And she came back, but she was still mentally ill, and it just didn't work.
It's an incredibly painful past for you, but reading your poems, you've transformed them into such beautiful language. But I wanted to focus again on something that you said when you were describing your mother, and you said, despite being a golden-skinned kid with an afro explosion of hair and freckles splattered over my face, despite having a smile that covered almost half my head, I learned how to dim.
Right.
Is that where the writing comes from, actually, from dimming your light?
I think that the dimming of the light came from trying to sort of survive that relationship. I actually think, the writing is actually the reverse. It's actually, sort of exposing light and generating and creating light out of something that's sort of terrible. So I think the poetry is actually the reverse. It's actually trying to generate and create something that this life experience was worth something. Even though it was terrible, it was worth something. And I think that's where the idea of light plays in this sort of writing.
Well, let's hear another poem. Would you read Green Bowls for us?
Sure. The Green Bowls. My lover bought me green bowls. I had none, green or otherwise. I served dessert on saucers and never had more than one guest. Later, he brought two irregular spoons, long with a tiny scoop. He didn't know these were properly used to stir iced tea. I didn't mind. We sat on my futon waving the wands, eating small bits of pie. The pie seemed to last much longer. When he unwrapped two plates the same shade as the bowls, I knew I was in love but would have to cook. We stood over the kitchen counter as if taken by surprise. Center in sheets of newsprint lay not ordinary plates, but a new shape entering our lives.
Now that sounds to me like what you were talking about before, you finding empathy for your mother and putting yourself in her place. Is that accurate?
The Green Bowls is actually a poem that happened later. It's actually a poem about my relationship with my partner in the very beginning.
Oh, that's really interesting.
Yeah, like it took me a long time sort of, I think, to trust him and to trust people. And so it's almost sort of like a gesture, like these green bowls were a gesture, like to sort of give in, because of my parents' relationship, and I love them to death, but because of my parents' relationship, I just don't, let people enter very easily. And I think that poem came out of our relationship with my partner.
Do you find, I hear echoes between that and how your mother must have felt. I mean, it doesn't sound like she let people in easily either.
That's probably true. And I, again, like writing the poems, about my mother, I had empathy for her because it must have been difficult to be in your 20s to, totally come to a new country, not speak the language. You've got like an African-American husband, so you've got a new family. Koreans are very, how should I put it? We like our own kind. So, she comes to America, she's got this whole different family, and, she has to sort of make a way. She's got this child who's, completely American, that she probably has trouble relating to. And, it's just, I just think that, she had a lot to deal with. And then on top of that, to have mental illness and to to have an illness in a country where you don't speak the language must have been like crazy. Probably they had difficulty treating her because she didn't speak the language. And so it was a complicated time for her.
And for you.
Right.
Now, you went to the School for Creative and Performing Arts in Cincinnati. Do you sing?
No. And that's that's the thing. I went to the School for Creative and Performing Arts, and I don't dance, I don't sing, I don't act, but when the creative writing teacher there, Mary Hennigan, gave me, you know, books on James Baldwin, Maya Angelou, Nikki Giovanni. When I read that poetry, I knew that I could do that, that I could sing like that. Maybe I could write poems that would sing.
So that's one of the things. I mean, you teach now at Savannah State University, and I read where the advice you would give to younger poets was find a poet you love and keep them as a touchstone. So who is your touchstone?
You know, there were two poets. There's a poet named Philip Levine, who I absolutely, I loved. I found him when I was in college, and, you know, just he wrote this poetry that was so, it came from a working class background. And so I could identify with that. Like the poem, he wrote this poem about his brother coming home from working, I think at a factory, and his brother being so tired and collapsing on the bed. And I just thought of my father, and I just thought, that poem just engaged me completely. And then there was, another poet named Robert Kinsley, who wrote poems about his family, and they were so moving and so they were so touching, and but they weren't sentimental, but they were so moving in the way that I carried those books in my backpack everywhere.
And I can imagine them paired up with all of your superhero comics, which is kind of an amazing that you,
yes.
You say.
I still collect comics.
Do you? Who's your favorite superhero?
You have to go with Wonder Woman because she's got the lasso and, you know, the bracelets. And
she is way tougher than as portrayed in those Justice League cartoons when we were growing up. Absolutely. Well, Sajana McCray, also much tougher than you might think. He's a poet and instructor at Savannah State University, and his book Rapture won the Walt Whitman Prize from the Academy of American Poets. So, Sajana, again, congratulations, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
And that's our show for today, but we love hearing from you and want to include your thoughts in our conversations. So tell us something interesting about the place where you live. What makes your town or city unique? Call and leave a message at 404-500-9457. You can also post on Facebook. For today, that's on Second Thought from GPB News. I'm Celeste Headley. Have a great day.